This continues, lest it come to scandal, the genesis of Jewish kingship, from Lot and his daughters to Judah and Tamar and the Book of Ruth. This is the sixth tape in the series. Okay, so I mentioned when we started this series has dealt with, is going to deal with three stories. The three stories are Lot and his daughters, Judah and Tamar, and Ruth. So far we've talked about Lot and his daughters, talked about Judah and Tamar. Tonight we're going to try and pull it together with Ruth. Let me summarize by just giving a global view of these stories for a moment. I think I remarked that if you look sort of at the broad canvas of Sefer Bereishit, of the book of Genesis, and you had to ask yourself, what is this book about? What would you say this book is about? Well, if you discount the first few stories of Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel and Noah as an experiment that didn't get off the ground the way it should, and the world was destroyed, and we started again from scratch, and if you start from there, you can really divide Sefer Bereishit into two main stories. And those are two stories that occupy 95% of Sefer Bereishit. And what are those two stories? Story number one centers around who? Abraham. And story number two centers around who? Yosef. Okay? Story number, no, it's just in terms of the lion's share of the book, right? Most of the first half of the book centers around the story of Abram. Most of the second half of the book centers around the story of Yosef and the epic struggle between Yosef and his brothers and Yosef and Mitzrayim and all of that. Okay? But interestingly, if you look at those two stories, it strikes me that each of those stories has a digression within it that doesn't really belong. That for some reason there's a chapter in each one of those stories that seems out of place, where a tangential character, a character that has not occupied center stage until now, suddenly occupies center stage. We forget about the main character, we focus upon this character. What are those two stories? The story in the story of the tangential story in the story of Abraham is the story of what? The story of Lot and his daughters and the destruction of Sodom, where Abraham is no longer the main character and the focus revolves around a relative of his who until now has been a minor character. Lot now occupies center stage. And in the Joseph story, there's also another digression that doesn't belong. It's chapter 38. It's the story of Judah and Tamar, where another relative of the main character assumes center stage. Well, you might say that's a coincidence. Two chapters that are digressions, each involving relatives of the main character. That's true. But if you look at those two stories carefully, you'll find that there are a number of uncanny similarities between those two stories. For example, both stories involve seduction. They involve some sort of sexual seduction between the woman and the man. Okay? In both stories, the woman is active and the man is relatively passive. Tamar is active. The daughters of Lot are active. Now, if we look morally at the stories, what moral place does the woman occupy and what moral place does the man occupy? In other words, in both stories, the woman occupies a similar kind of place. Does she act out of good motives or evil motives? In both cases, good motives. She acts out of noble motives, and the man in both cases operates out of lust or something like that. And in both cases, interestingly, the woman keeps her motives secret. Tamar keeps her motives secret, will not feel that she can't reveal her real agenda to Judah, and so do the daughters, and they feel a need to get their father drunk because they feel that they can't reveal their agenda to him. So the stories start looking more and more similar, these two digressions. Interestingly, another aspect of the stories that's similar is that both seductions involve a quasi-incestual kind of act. In other words, an act of intimacy between a father and his daughter, or ultimately a father and his daughter-in-law. Okay, Tamar is the daughter-in-law of Judah, and Lot's daughters, obviously, are the daughters of Lot. But the motives of the daughters, interestingly, are virtually the same, or are very similar in some way, which is, what is the motive of Tamar? What's she doing this for? Why is she seducing Yehuda? It's because she wants a child, but it's not just that she's a woman who wants a child. She has a noble reason for wanting a child, which is Yibum, loyalty to her dead husband. Her first husband dies without child. The concept of Yibum says that she can marry the brother of the deceased, and the brother of the deceased acts as a surrogate kind of father, stepping into the relationship, keeping alive that relationship. Remember, Yibum, the way Yibum works, in an existential sense, it's that he steps into that relationship. It's that, as I've said before, generally speaking, the way that marriage is terminated is either through divorce or through the death of the husband. But the exception to that rule is when the husband dies and there are no children. At that point, the marriage is not completely terminated. The marriage is in limbo. The marriage can be terminated if the woman and the man choose chalitza, if they choose to sever the residual bond between them, between the brother of the deceased and the woman. But if they choose to, they can also actualize that marriage, bring that marriage in limbo back to life. And that's why in Yibum there is no new act of marriage. If a man performs Yibum with a woman, he simply moves in and begins to live with her because there's no new marriage. There's nothing new that happens. Okay? He's stepping in literally to the shoes of the deceased. It's a complete act of surrogacy. Not really him, it's not really his child, it's the child of his brother. It's an act of loyalty on both the part of the woman and the part of the man. So if you asked why it was that Tamar did this, the answer is out of loyalty to her deceased husband and a desire to propagate his legacy, which she feels would otherwise be destroyed. Now ask why it is that the daughters of Lot feel a need to have this quasi-incestual act with their father. What is it? They thought it was the end of the world, not just the end of their father's legacy, but the end of humankind's legacy. That the only way to propagate the legacy of the human race was through this act of incest. So interestingly, there's an uncanny similarity between the motives of the two women in these cases. What's most fascinating of all, and perhaps the deepest connection between these two stories, is that not only are the stories connected in all of these thematic elements, but they're connected in another way too. But that connection you don't see in the book of Genesis. You have to wait for the book of Ruth for. Because what is fascinating is that both of these stories end up becoming the same story. And they become the same story in the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth is where these two stories join together. Because the act of intimacy between Lot and his daughters produces two children. And the act of intimacy between Tamar and Yehuda produces two children. The first children are Peretz and Zerach. The second children are Peretz and Zerach. The first children are Ammon and Moab. In Ruth, we finally have those two stories coming together. We have a descendant of Moab, a Moabite woman by the name of Ruth, who ends up marrying a descendant of Peretz from the story of Judah and Tamar, Boaz. And the union of those two people is what the story of Ruth is about. And the union of those two people creates Ovid, who is the father of Yishai, who is the father of David. What we have in these two digressions of the book of Genesis are not two haphazard stories that happen to interrupt the flow of Genesis, but on a deeper level, what they become is the seeds of a dynasty that is yet to be, that is only realized in the book of Ruth. The theory that I have in this book, which I've articulated before, is that the book of Ruth is not just the genealogical coming together in those two stories, but is the spiritual coming together of those two stories. In other words, the themes that were actualized with Lot and his daughters, and the themes that were actualized with Judah and Tamar come together in the book of Ruth, and when they come together, it produces royalty. It produces King David, or it produces the potential for King David. The question is, what are those themes, and how do they come together in Ruth? That's what we're going to be talking about a little bit tonight. Okay? All right. So let's talk about Ruth. One interesting thing you could do with Ruth, I'm not sure if we're going to have enough time to do this exhaustively tonight, but if not, you can do this for your Shavuos homework, is to trace the parallels between the book of Ruth and the story of Judah and Tamar also. Because the book of Ruth is very similar to the story of Judah and Tamar in a number of ways. And if you remind me at the end of this presentation, I'll get back to some of the ways in which this is so. Just keep in mind that in fact is the case. There's parallel after parallel between these stories. But let me just ask you this. I have to tell you that maybe it was because I was young and naive and all of that, but as a kid, whenever Shavuos came along and I read the book of Ruth, I have to confess that I never had the faintest idea of what was going on. That when I read the book of Ruth, I could never really understand what the book was about. I mean, let me ask you, the question I always had in the book of Ruth, I could never follow the plot, I have to tell you. I mean, I knew it was a story about this lady and comes back from Moab and Beit Lechem, there's this famine, and she marries Boaz, but I couldn't get it. Like, what's happening in the story? In other words, there's two kinds of stories in the Torah, right? Two kinds of stories that you can tell in general. If you read American short stories, there's two kinds of short stories you can write. Short story number one is what we call a slice of life. Short story number two is a story that's organized thematically around an idea. So you could have a slice of life or a painting that's a slice of life. What's a painting that's a slice of life? The artist walked in and there was a banana peel on the table and there was an apple on the table and there's some stuff, so he painted it. You want to understand the unity of the picture? The unity of the picture is that's what was there during, you know, when he walked in the room. Okay? That's one kind of picture. And you can have stories like that, Faulkner stories. A slice of life in the South, right? A slice of life in the town of Bethlehem. One day in the town of Bethlehem, there was this lady. She came home, saw this guy, they got married, right? So that's one possibility. What is the Book of Ruth about? It's a day in the life of Bethlehem. Guess what happened? That's one possibility. The other possibility is that the story is thematically organized. When a story is thematically organized, there tends to be a plot, right? There, in the plot, there's usually a setup, tension, and climax, right? Then if that's the case, what is the story? I mean, this is a very basic question. Right? It's not a fancy question. What is the story of the Book of Ruth? What is the plot here? What is the setup? What is the tension? And what is the resolution? What is the climax? What makes this story hang together? Truth is, the answer is obvious, but I never understood it as a child. I just always read it as a slice of life story. What is the plot in this book? So let's talk about what the plot is. What makes this story tick? No, I mean, is this a good question? What makes this... What? It's a very basic question. I mean, what is this book about? I mean, here's the story. Ruth comes home from Moab one day, right? And she tells Naomi, tragedy, husband's died, right? And she's collecting food, and she meets Boaz, and she is by the field, and they're penniless, they don't have anything to eat, and they're walking around. And then by the end of the book, you notice that, you know, one day Ruth comes and she's lying down next to Boaz. Boaz says something about, in the morning we'll see about things. They come, there's a ceremony, some funny ceremony with this guy Ploni Almoni. He's supposed to redeem something. He doesn't end up redeeming it. Boaz redeems. They get married and everyone lives happily ever after. I mean, what was the story about? I mean, you tell me. I mean, was it just like sort of a romance novel? Here's this poor girl. She falls in love, gets married. Everyone lives happily ever after. What is this book about? What's the tension in this book? Everyone with me? I mean, is this a reasonable question? Nothing fancy here. Just tell me what the book is about, right? That is the question I always had with Ruth. So if we do nothing more tonight, right, we will answer this question. What is this book about more than a slice of life and just a little romance in Beit Lechem, okay? All right. Now, there's a couple issues which I think we need to discuss in the Book of Ruth to look on that sort of, you know, semi-intelligently. Let me raise a couple issues. First of all, the beginning of the book is a little strange. It happened at the time of the judges. There was a famine in the land. Vayelech ish mi-Beit Lechem Yehuda, and a man from the Bethlehem in Judah. Notice, by the way, how the author goes out of his way to tell us where Bethlehem is located. The Bethlehem is in Judah. Beit Lechem is in Judah. And he goes lagur b'stei Moab, to the fields of Moab. Hu v'ishto ushnei banav, he and his wife and his two children. The Shema Ish, now we get to what the name of the man was. The man's name was Elimelech. The Shema Ishto Naomi, and the name of his wife was Naomi. And we now hear the name of his two children. Shema Shnebanav, Machlon v'Kilion. The name of his two children were Machlon and Kilion. Ephratim from Ephrat, near Beit Lechem, Yehuda, in Judah. Vayavo stei Moab vayusham. They came to the land of Moab and they were there. Vayamat Elimelech Ish Naomi, and Elimelech dies, the husband of Naomi. Vatisha Erhu Shnebanea. Now all she has is her and her two sons. Now her two sons get married. They get married to Moabite girls. Shema Achad Arpa, the Shema Shanit Rud. The name of one was Arpa, the name of the second was Ruth. They're there about 10 years. And then guess what? Machlon and Kilion die. Now there's three dead men. And now she's all alone. She doesn't have her husband anymore and she doesn't have her two sons. Okay? And now they decide to go back from Moab. Right, so there's a couple strange things here. First of all, the names are strange. What are the names of these two children here? Anyone pay attention to what the names were? What are the names?
Machlon
and Kilion. Okay. Now think about that for a moment. Let's just translate the words. What does Machlon and Kilion mean? Let's translate Machlon. What does it mean? Machla. What's a machla? A disease. Okay? All right. Child A is named Disease. Okay? That's what a beautiful name for your child, right? Now, what is Kilion named? Kilion comes from what?
Kala,
Kalia. What does Kalia mean? Destruction. Okay? What a beautiful name for a child. So what are these two kids? Disease and destruction. Right? I mean, those are like the weirdest names you could ever imagine naming your two kids. Come here, disease. Hey, destruction. Come on over. I mean, what do you call out to these kids in the supermarket? It's like a little embarrassing, right? So what's the deal with naming these kids disease and destruction? So this is a good question, right? So you always have this question in Tanakh. Is it really the name or is it a euphemism? I'm not going to venture a guess here, but I wouldn't be surprised if the Tanakh took the liberty of assigning names to people that sometimes may have actually had a different name. Because remember, the Torah is not a history book. It's not there just to recount history to you. It's there to tell you what you need to know from history. It's there to tell you the story that you need to hear. Right? And sometimes the Torah can convey meaning by naming people things. Why would the Torah name people disease and destruction? I mean, something's wrong. Now, it turns out there's another element here which we need to deal with. It's a principle which I happen to use a lot, which is that the Torah, oftentimes when it makes use of a word repetitively, it is trying to assign your attention to it. Now, in our story, we have a word, a verb, which appears over and over again. Okay? It appears lots of times. Let's see if you can pick it up. I'll read you a couple of verses in which it appears. Boaz told me that I can be around his field until he finishes the harvest. Later on, and she indeed stayed with Boaz to pick until he finished the barley harvest. Okay? Later on, Naomi to Ruth, Rachatz v'sacht v'samsim l'tayich, I want you to get dressed and to wash up and go down to the threshing floor. Al tivadi l'ish ad kalot olach halishtot. Don't tell anyone until he finishes eating and drinking. All right. V'tashav Ruth v'Naomi ha-Moavia kalata ima ha-shava misdei Moav. And Naomi and Ruth, the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, came back from the field of Moab. Later on, Naomi to Ruth, 3:18. You don't have to worry about Boaz. He will not remain still until he finishes off the thing today. Have you picked it up yet, what the word is? What? Kila. Okay, chala. Let me give you some examples of this. Every time we meet Ruth and Orpah, they're always referred to, even after we know it's true, as the chaloteha, the daughters-in-law of Naomi. Now, you'd think that we knew already they were the daughters-in-law of Naomi once they were introduced that way, and we could have safely referred to them as Ruth and Orpah. But no, we always hear over and over again that they are the chaloteha, kala, chaf lamed hey, daughter-in-law. Turns out that the kala means other things besides daughter-in-law, and the word appears in spades in its other meaning as well. The other thing that chala means is to finish off or to bring to fruition. For example, to finish off the barley harvest until the barley harvest is finished off. Or Boaz will not rest until he finishes the thing today. Or until you finish eating and drinking in 3:3, until the harvest is over, 2:23. But chala can also have a darker side to it as well. And indeed, by the way, one of the children is also known with the root chala. Because guess who has the root chala in his name? But Kilion comes from the root chala. And there it means finish off in not such a nice way. Because what does Kilion mean? It means destruction. What's interesting is that the verb chala can mean two things. It can mean either destruction or it can mean bring to fruition. Now why would you have one Hebrew word that could either mean destruction or bring to fruition? It must be there's a core meaning from which both destruction and bringing to fruition derive. What's the core meaning? Ending. Bring to an end. Okay? There's two ways you can bring something to an end. You can either raise it up to accomplish its potential, and then you bring something to fruition and it's over because it's accomplished its potential. Or you can take something that has potential and destroy it, and then that's destruction. Either way, it's over. Now, one way is nice and one way is not so nice, but it's over. So chala can mean either kind of act, and it appears in both of those meanings in this story. But interestingly enough, the other thing it means is daughter-in-law. And over again, we get daughter-in-law as referred to as chalaseha. Now, why is it that we always have to hear these girls are chalaseha? And why is it that we have one kid who is named Kilion, And by the way, we have one kid named Machlon, disease and destruction. And by the way, which one is Orpah married to, and which one is Ruth married to? Anyone know? Machlon is Ruth, and Kilion is Orpah. Okay? Why is it that Ruth married Machlon, and Orpah married Kilion? Is that just coincidence, or does that have something to do with their names as well? It's an interesting question. So, I would like to bring all of this back to what the Book of Ruth is about. What is the theme of the Book of Ruth? What is this book really about? The theory I'm going to suggest to you tonight is that the Book of Ruth is about this word. It's about kala. It's about bringing things to their end. But there's two ways you can bring something to its end. You can either destroy it, or you can actualize its potential. That is the central tension of the Book of Ruth. Which one is it going to be for these daughters-in-law, for these chalas? There are two daughters-in-law, and there's a choice open to both of them. The choice is, which kind of chala is it going to be? Is it going to be destruction, or is it going to bring it to fruition? Because those are the only two possibilities. Why is that the choice? What is the tension of the Book of Ruth? What is this book really about? Let's go back and note the similarities to the story of Yehuda and Tamar. In the story of Judah and Tamar, we had a story of what? Yibum. Here we have a story of Yibum also, a possible Levirate marriage. The story where, what happened in Judah and Tamar, a man died and he didn't have any children, his wife was left a widow. Well, what happens here? We have a man, Elimelech, who gives birth to two children, Machlon and Kilion. The two children get married, Elimelech dies, the two children die, there's no children. What do we have now? We have triple Yibum. Elimelech's dead. The only ones who could carry on his legacy are Machlon and Kilion, except Machlon and Kilion are now dead, having married a woman with no children. That means there are three men whose potential legacy is in jeopardy now, that their family line can come to an end. Who are the only two rays of hope? They're Orpah and Ruth. However, there's a problem with Orpah and Ruth. The problem is that who are they going to marry? Right? They got to marry a brother of the deceased. The problem is there's no brother. Okay? Right? What does this remind you of? It reminds you of, in the Judah and Tamar story, right? Two children dead, no other eligible relative because he's 6 years old. Now, the difference, remember, between the stories is that at least in Tamar there was Shelah who was six. Here there's nobody. But that point gets etched into relief in the story when you have Naomi who tells her daughters to go back. And why does she tell her daughters to go back? She says telling words. She says the following. I'm going to read the words for you. Latomer Naomi l'shtei chaloteha. And Naomi said to her two kalas, chalas, her two finisher offers, Lech na shovna, give it up. Go back. Isha lebeit ima, go back to your mother's house. Ya'aseh Hashem imachem chesed. Let God do chesed for you, do kindness for you. Kasher asitem ima meitim v'imadi, as you've done for the people who are dead, for your husbands, and with me. You've done good to me, you've done good to them. Let's call it a day. Go home. Yiten Hashem lachem u'metzena menucha, isha beit isha. Let God give you peace. Let God give you rest. I hope you find rest. I hope you find peace. It's a strange, by the way, blessing that he gives her. I hope that you find peace, she says. Let God give you menucha, isha beit isha, each woman in her own house. Vatishak lahen, and she kissed them, vatisa'ena kolan vatifkena, and they raised their voice and they cried. Vatamar na'lan, they said to her, ki itach nashuv la'amech, no, we're going to go back with you to your people. Vatamar na'ami, but Naomi insisted and said, shovna benotai, go back, my daughters. Lama te'lach na'imi, how come you're going to go back with me? Now listen to these words. Ha'od li banim b'me'ai v'ayu lachem la'nashim, do I have any children in my womb that could possibly be husbands for you? There she refers to it. Yibum is on everyone's mind. The possibility that they could marry a brother of the deceased and be loyal to their husbands and carry on that line. But she says there is no such brother. And now listen to the next words. Shovna benotai, go back, my daughters. Go back, lechna, run back. Kizakanti mi yob'ish, because I am too old to be anymore with a man. Ki amarti yeshli tikva, such that I would say that I have hope of having children. Gam hayiti alayla liish, and even if I weren't so old, and I would marry a man tonight, the gam yaladati banim, and I would conceive right away. Halahen tisaberna, would you grow old waiting for those children? Ad asher yigdalu, until they grow up. Halahen ta'agena, will you be chained for those children forever and not go on with your lives? Levilti hayod la'ish, not to marry any other man. Al banotai, no, my daughters. Kimar li ma'od mikem, that would be too bitter for me on your account. Ki yatza biyad Hashem, because the hand of God has gone against me. It's God's will. Let's accept it. Let's go on. What do you see here? Almost a direct parallel to the story of Yehuda and Tamar. What did she say? Even if I had children now, they would be too young for you to marry. Are you going to wait and become old? Listen to this language. Halahen tisaberna, will you grow white-haired? Ad asher yigdalu, until they grow up. Now listen to those words. Ad asher yigdalu. When in Tanakh do we have those words again? When other time in Tanakh do we have ad asher yigdalu? Ad asher yigdalu. Only one other time in Tanakh. Ad asher yigdalu. Yehuda to Tamar. Wait ad asher yigdal Shela bani. Wait until Shela, my son, gets old. She's quoting from that. Tamar was told to wait. And she did wait. And here she says, what are you going to do? You're going to wait like Tamar until my child grows up? It's too bitter. Don't do that. What happens? Orpah goes back. Orpah accepts the offer. Vatisena kolan vativkena. They both then cry, Vatishak Orpah lechamota v'rutav dekaba. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, and Ruth clung to her. Vatomer, and she says in these famous words, Hinei shava yivimtech alama. He says, the other woman who could have had Yibum now goes back to her people, v'el Elohim, to her gods. Shuv yachar yivimtech, you go also. He says to Ruth, Vatomer Ruth, but Ruth says, by the way, it could be that it's from here that we learn that you're supposed to turn away a convert three times. Because actually that's what Naomi did. If you count the times, there's three times he tells her to go back, and Ruth insists three times no. There's three times he says, Shovna benotai. I wonder, I bet the Gemara makes that comparison. So Vatomer Ruth, and Ruth says, Al tifki'i bi la'azveich la'shuv me'acharayich. Don't insist again to tell me to go back from you. Because whether you go and straight where you go, I will go. Basher talini alin, and where you sleep, I will sleep. Ameich ami, your people is my people. Elohayich Elohai, your God is my God. Basher tamuti amut, where you die, I will die. Visham ekaver, and there I will be buried. Ko yaseh Hashem li v'cho yosif, I swear, she says in the name of God, ki amavet yafrid beini ubeinecha, only death will come between us to make us part. Pretty strong words. And at that point, Vatera kimitza metat hilavoita, lalechatita, and then she sees that Ruth is strong and wanting to come with her, vatechdala daber alea, and she stops trying to convince her otherwise, and they both go back to Beit Lechem together. What is this story about? What this story is about kala. It's about finishing off. What do we have here? We have unfinished business. The same way that you had in the story of Yehuda and Tamar, unfinished business, you have unfinished business here. You have a man that has died. Now, the normal thing would be to give up and go on. However, there is a possibility of Yibum. Here, it's a very remote possibility because there aren't even any brothers. And Naomi says how remote. Even if I had children now, you couldn't grow up. But Ruth is so devoted to the legacy and to the memory of her dead husband, so devoted to him, even in death, that she is willing to put her life on hold and dedicate herself to make sure that he doesn't go off into the wind, that there will be a remembrance of his name. And she hopes against hope that there will be some way to re-actualize this marriage. Some way. How? She has no idea. But maybe there can be some way. You can't reason with her. Naomi says all the right things to her. It makes sense what Naomi's saying. Ruth doesn't listen. She's so devoted to the memory of deceased, she's trying to find a way. The tension of the book of Ruth is, will she succeed? Which kala will it be? There is a relationship in limbo here between her and her dead husband. And now look at the names of the two children. Orpah is married to Kilion. Why do you think Orpah is married to Kilion and Ruth is married to Mahlon? What does Kilion mean? Destruction. Why was Orpah married to destruction? Because once Orpah ended it and went back, it was over for Kilion. And he was destroyed. But who is Ruth married to? Mahlon. Disease. Why disease? Because he's not dead yet. In a deep way, Mahlon is not really dead. He's just diseased. This relationship is in limbo. It can go one of two ways. It can be destroyed. If Yibum is not found, it's over. Machlon dies and is not Machlon anymore. But if Yibum exists, then the possibility of resuscitating this relationship and bringing a child in that can carry on his legacy exists, and then he's not really dead. So she's married to the diseased one. And the question is, what will be with Machlon? What will be for this whole line of Elimelech? It's not just Machlon, by the way, it's also Elimelech, because it's sort of a double Yibum, because if she succeeds in finding Yibum, she not only keeps the line of Machlon going, she keeps the line of Elimelech, the father, going, because Machlon was the only continuation for Elimelech. So I think the real question in Ruth is, these two Kalas, these two finisher off her daughters-in-law, which of the two Kalas is it going to be? Is it going to be Kilion for everybody, or is it going to be bringing to fruition for everybody? But it's got to be one or the other. And the end of the story is when Ruth succeeds against all hopes. And the tension of the story is, will she find someone? In the end, magically, she finds Boaz. Just like in Judah and Tamar, there was an unconventional Yibum, someone who wasn't the brother, but was a more distant relative of the family. Here, too, there wasn't a brother, but there was a more distant relative. There was a Boaz. And Boaz was able to marry and to bring together the Yibum. So that is one theme in this story, which is at the most basic level, the story is a tension of, will this woman find the ability for Yibum? Much like the story of Judah and Tamar is that same story. Will Tamar succeed in finding Yibum? And by the way, that explains another thing also, which is that, you know, Boaz has a very strange name. When Naomi finally realizes that Boaz is related, she says to Ruth the following very interesting thing, beginning of chapter 3. But Tamarla Naomi, and Naomi says, her mother-in-law says to Ruth, Biti, my daughter, halo avakesh lach manoach asher yitav lach. I'm going to find you a manoach who will be good for you. Now, what does she mean, I'm going to find you a manoach? What is the word manoach here? I'm going to find you an ex who will be good to you. What does she really mean? I'm going to find you a husband. Naomi's going to try and find her a husband. I'm going to try and find you a husband. Now, can someone tell me what the word in Hebrew for husband is? It's not manoach. What does manoach mean? Resting. I'm going to find you a resting who will be good for you. Does that mean anything? I'm going to find you a manoach, a resting person who will be good for you. What a strange synonym for husband, a resting person. But it recalls another thing Naomi said. Remember the bracha that Naomi gave her two daughters-in-law when she was trying to get them to stay in Moab? What did he say? Yiten Hashem lachem menucha. Let God give you what? Rest. Let you find rest. The big blessing for these children is, let them find rest. And now the name for the husband is going to be rest. He's going to be a manoach. What does this mean? This whole story is about finding rest. It's putting an end to the quest. You can find rest when it's over. Remember Jacob. Jacob can't find rest for the death of Yosef because it's not over, because Yosef's not really dead. Judah can't find rest for the death of his sons because his sons, there's still the possibility for Yibum. Tamar mourns forever for the sons because it's unfinished business. There's the possibility of bringing this all back. You can never rest. The family of a missing and absent soldier does not rest. That's the tragedy of it. It grates on you for years and years. You literally can't rest. You pray to end it one way or the other. That's why it always struck me as strange that, you know, it's like the relatives of, God forbid, you know, the relatives of the World Trade Center bombing, they found it as such a gift when they could find some DNA from their, just a piece of the clothes of somebody who was killed in there, because then they knew it was over. It's something which, God forbid, no one should ever be in that situation. You can't understand it. To us, it makes no sense. It should be a comfort for you that you found a scrap of clothing. If you found the guy alive, I understand it's a comfort. He's dead. How are you comforted? The answer is no. You don't understand the torture of not knowing for sure, of being in a state of unfinished business where someone's dead, but he's not really dead in your mind. Because maybe, maybe, maybe. The worst thing is that you can't rest. Your nights, all night long, you're up thinking, maybe, maybe, it's torture. And what you want more than anything is just rest. Let it be over one way or the other. Either let him live or let him die. But let it be over. Let me be able to go on. And to find the scrap is at least to let it be over. And that's what Naomi says to her. He says, you know what? Let's call it quits. Let's cut our losses. It's awful. It's terrible. They're dead. But yitan Hashem lachem menucha. At least God will give you rest. You can move on. You can call it a day. You forget about Yibum. Go on. But Ruth, to her credit, does not take the easy solution of rest, is willing to go and live a fitful, unrestful life for years, like Tamar, and to search constantly in an unrestful, fitful kind of state for some sort of salvation for the possibility of the other kind of rest. A rest is, which is not the rest of destruction where you find a scrap of clothing, but a rest which is the rest of fruition, where you can bring this back to life, where you can keep the line going. And when that glimmer of hope finally becomes real, when Boaz appears on the horizon, Naomi says, you know what, let me give you a different kind of rest. Instead of the rest of destruction, which I blessed you before, there's another kind of rest that we can hope for on Manoach, a husband who will be a resting place that you can end this quest with your dream, with being able to bring it to fruition. And that's the dream which begins to glimmer when we find Boaz. And by the way, the significance of this is not, again, as I mentioned before, just with Machlan, it's for Elimelech also. And you see it in an interesting way. When Naomi tells Ruth to go down to the Goren, to wait for Boaz, to go down to the threshing floor to wait for Boaz, there's a very interesting series of Kri and Ketiv. You notice that in the Torah there's a Kri and Ketiv, which is there's the way the words are written, but the way they're pronounced. And sometimes there's a discrepancy between the two. When there's a discrepancy between the two, oftentimes they're not just mistakes, it is that the editor is trying to tell you something with the double meaning of words. I want you to look at the Kri and Ketivs for a moment, what Naomi tells Ruth to do. Here you have it. Listen carefully. She says, V'rachatzt, I want you to go down and wash yourself. V'sacht, and to anoint yourself. V'samt sim lasayich alecha, alayich, and to put your clothes upon you, your dress upon you. V'yarad et hagoren, and to go down to the threshing floor. And then later on she says, and I want you to go to sleep, v'shachavt, and to sleep next to him, and he will tell you what to do. And later on he says, V'tomer eleha, and Ruth then says to her, Everything that you said, I will do. Okay? Now, I want you to listen to this fascinating series of Kri and Ketiv. That's the way the words are pronounced. But how are they written? They're written differently than they're pronounced. If you had pronounced them the way that they are written, here's what the words would actually say. She says, I want you to go down, v'sach. Now, the ketiv is, v'yaradati hagoren. There's an extra yud. Instead of v'yaradat hagoren, and you should go down to the threshing floor, it's v'yaradati hagoren. What does that mean if you add the yud? It means I will go down to the threshing floor. And then later on, I want you to go and sleep next to him. The shachavti is the ketiv. And I will sleep next to him. Okay? And then when Ruth answers, I will do everything that you say. Vatomra eleha kol asher tamri aseh. And she says to her, everything you say, the ketiv is vatomra elai. And she says to herself, everything that you say, I will do. What's happening here with the Kri and Ketiv? Why is it that Naomi, that there's a strange thing, that in Naomi's words, instead of saying, she's clearly talking to Ruth, instead of just saying to Ruth, I want you to sleep next to him, there's this Ketiv, I will sleep next to him. I want you to put on your dress, I'll put on my dress. I want you to go down to the threshing floor, I'm going to go down to the threshing floor. When Ruth answers, not just that Ruth answers her, but the Ketiv is Ruth answers herself. There's an identity crisis going on here. What's happening? What's happening is, look at the global picture here. Naomi is invested in this too. Because Naomi's husband Elimelech is also dead, and she wants to perpetuate his memory, and the only way to do it is through the Yibum of Ruth, keeping alive the legacy of not just Machlon, but of the father Elimelech. And therefore, with Ruth doing this act of Yibum, she's in fact vicariously acting not just on behalf of this one husband, but on the behalf of Naomi and Elimelech too. Therefore, vicariously, it says, if Naomi herself is going down to be with him, and as if Naomi has invested herself within Ruth, so that it's almost existentially, when Boaz is with Ruth, it's as if he's with Naomi and Ruth, right, giving birth to a child that will also be the legacy of Elimelech. And therefore, when Ruth answers her, she doesn't just answer externally to her, but she answers herself. It's as if they've become the same body, and there's an identification. Yes, I will do what it is that we need to do. Are you with me on that? So, in other words, I think there's that. There's a great significance. It's Elimelech's line as well as Machlon's line, which has been continued. Yeah.
So that would have a lot to do with the baby was born.
Ah, exactly. Now, notice that who nurses the baby? Naomi. Not only that, when the townspeople talk about the baby, do you know what they say? Yulad ben la Naomi. A child has been born to Naomi. What do you mean a child has been born to Naomi? A child has been born to Ruth. Who's Ruth? Mashed potatoes? No. It's Ruth and Naomi, right? Because it's Elimelech also. Elimelech's line's been kept alive. So both of these women are in it. It's about both of them. Okay. By the way, speaking of Yehuda and Tamar, just to throw this in, talking about links of Yehuda and Tamar, Remember the names, the name, it's not just the names Machlon and Kilion are strange, but the two children in the story of Yehuda and Tamar that die, that are parallel to the two children Machlon and Kilion. Remember there's two children in Yehuda and Tamar that die leaving the possibility of Yibam. There's two children here that die leaving the possibility of Yibam. They have strange names in the story of Judah and Tamar also. What are their names? Er and Onan. Very strange names. Talked about this morning. What does the name Er mean? The name Er means awake. What does the name Onan mean? Grief. Right? These children are named Awake and Grief. Very strange names for children. Now think about Machlon and Kilion. Diseased and destruction. See any parallel between these names? Who was named Er and who was named Onan? Awake was the guy that first married Tamar. He died. Then Onan was called upon to do Yibam. He was grief. But he dies because he fails to be loyal and to give birth to children. Okay, to me, why do you think Er is called Er again? Why is he Mr. Awake? Wow. He's dead.
It's his seed that you're trying to...
Right, because he can be awoken. Mm-hmm. Right? Because he's dead, but he's awake. He's not dead. He's awake even as he's dead. It's unfinished business. He's living dead. I mean, that is, it's a curse, really, to be the living dead. You can't even have the peace of the grave to die because you're alive, because maybe you can be continued, and it's not over yet, right? So who is called upon to bring this to fruition? Onan, but he doesn't. So he's in grief, but he fails to bring it through. So, but Onan also dies in this act. It's almost as if Machlon and Kilion are parallel to Er and Onan. Machlon is diseased but still awake. Kilion is destroyed. Er is diseased but still awake. But then there's the grief, right? The utter destruction of Onan. So the two children seem to be parallel as well. One other interesting parallel between these two stories, which sheds light on the meaning of them, is the theme of recognition. We talked in the story of Judah and Tamar about the theme of recognition being key to that story, that there is a train of recognition, a sorry train of recognition, which begins actually in the story of Yaakov and Esav, but really gets in spades when Yaakov deceives his father and causing him to have an inability to recognize him. V'lo hiki ruhu, he doesn't recognize him. It reaches a new low point in the story of Yehuda's deception of his father when he says, Hakerna, recognize please this cloak, holding up a bloody cloak that it gives the false impression that Yosef has been killed. We mentioned that Tamar quotes those exact same words that Yehuda said to his father, recognize please the cloak, when she has a cloak of Yehuda and presents it to him, much as Yehuda had presented the cloak to his father, and just like Yehuda put the ball in his father's court and said, can you recognize this? She puts the ball in his court and says, can you recognize this cloak? Giving him a chance to redeem that first recognition. We talked about Yehuda's greatness as his ability to, in fact, redeem that recognition, to be able to redeem the faults of his failure of leadership in the story of Yosef and his brothers, and to redeem those faults when he has the heroic recognition, even in the face of terrible scandal, of this cloak. We talked about that recognition operating at a couple of levels. It operates not just at the level of physically recognizing a cloak, but at a deeper level of recognizing the reality in the relationship between these two people, which is that there is a reality in the relationship with Tamar which he has failed to recognize until now, which he now comes face to face with and makes a very painful recognition, which is that it seems to the outside world that Tamar is the bad girl. She got herself pregnant when she should have been waiting, and Yehuda is the great wonderful judge who condemns her to death, when in fact the opposite is true. It is that Tamar has waited and acted nobly, hoping to act for the loyalty of her dead brother, and succeeds in seducing Yehuda to be able to continue that line. But Yehuda is actually the one who impregnated her, not knowing who she was, acting not out of any particularly kosher motives at face value. So Yehuda is actually the one who is below her, and she's the one who's above him. And that is what Yehuda is able to recognize, and that's Yehuda's greatness. That Yehuda can turn to her, and when he says, when he recognizes the cloak, he doesn't just recognize the cloak, but he recognizes the reality, he recognizes the reality of the relationship, when he says, Tzadka mimeni, she is more righteous than I. Those are difficult words for him to say. He's the judge who just condemned her to death. He now publicly says, she is more righteous than I, because she had noble motives in mind, and this is why she was intimate with me, and she is more righteous than I. She acted more righteous than I. In doing so, Yehuda has actualized his name. His name, Yehuda, comes from the word Hoda'ah. What Hoda'ah is at its core is it's an act of recognition. It's the act of recognition in which I look at a relationship in which you are up here and I am down here, and I recognize that fact. Whether the act of Hoda'ah is an act of admission of wrongdoing, that I admit that I did this to you and I am down here, you and up here, whether it is an act of thanks, the other kind of Hoda'ah, when I say that you did me a favor and you are up here and I am down here, either way it's a recognition of an imbalance in our relationships and it equalizes that relationship. That is what Hakara is all about. It is a key word in the story of Yehuda and Tamar, but guess what? It appears in the story of Ruth as well, in a very interesting place. It appears in a couple places, actually. Naomi tells Ruth to go down before anyone can recognize, and when it's so dark that you can't recognize your neighbor yet, uses that word, b'terem yakir ishet re'eu, before someone can be makir, can recognize their neighbor. But the very interesting place it appears is at an emotional high point in the story. And there it appears when Ruth has her first face-to-face confrontation with Boaz. What has happened? Ruth is in the field. She's working away in the field. And she's come back from Moab. She's a nobody in Beit Lechem. She's at the bottom of the totem pole. She's a little Moabite girl, destitute with her mother-in-law. They used to have everything, but now they have nothing. And Boaz is the main man in town. It's his field, and he's the one in power. And what happens? Boaz inquires after this woman, who is this girl gathering in our field? And he instructs his people to deal kindly with her, to give her water, and to give her some extra food, or some extra morsels to carry. And he tells Ruth that she doesn't have to worry, she doesn't have to be intimidated, she can be in her field, and it's okay, until the end of the harvest. At that point, Ruth has a conversation with him. Let's listen in, if we can, on that conversation. Vayomer Boaz el Ruth, and I'm reading now from chapter 1, verse 8. You should listen, my daughter. Don't go to any other field. Don't leave from here. Kotid bakimim narotai. You can cling to my servants. I've told my people not to bother you. Vitsamt, and when you're thirsty, go to the water of Shatit and you can drink from where they draw from the well. But she falls on her face and she bows down low before him. But Tomer I love, and she says to him, Madua matati chen be'enecha, how come I found favor in your eyes? Lahaki reini, insofar as you've recognized me, there's the word, vanochi nachriya, and I am not even Jewish, I am a stranger in this land. Okay, now, what is she saying? Listen to how the word haki reini is used over here. Why this word? Why have you found favor to be makir me, to recognize me when I am a stranger? Notice, by the way, that haki reini and nachriya are the same letters. Lama matzitachem lahaki reini, how come you have recognized me, vanochi nachriya, and I am a stranger? Do you recognize someone who's a stranger? No. You literally can't recognize them because you don't know who they are. On a deeper level, you don't recognize them in terms of giving them status in the community if a person is a nachriya, a stranger. And that's what she's asking him. She's saying, why have you recognized me when I'm a stranger? I'm a nobody in Beit Lechem. How come you're dealing with me in this kind way? But she characterizes it as an act of hakara, using that key word from the story of Yehuda and Tamar. Now listen to Boaz's response. Vaya'an Boaz. Boaz said, Hugaid hugadli kol asher asit et chamotech. It was told to me everything that you did for your mother-in-law, achrei moti sheikh, after your husband died, how you took care of her. You left behind your father and your mother, and you came to a nation that you didn't know yesterday and the day before. Yeshalem Hashem pa'aleich. Let God reward you. And let God give you a great reward for what you've done from the God of Israel, that you've come to find repose beneath his wings. Now, what is Boaz really saying? What Boaz is really saying is he's actually doing an act of hakara here. Remember, what is hakara always? Hakara always is a recognition that a relationship of the true imbalance in a relationship. That even though if I wanted to, I could lie and look like we're all even Stephen, but really the fact is we're not even Stephen, and I'm recognizing that in the relationship. What's happening here? Exactly the same thing. In other words, what Boaz is saying is, yeah, it may look like you're a nobody in Beit Lechem. It may look like I'm the somebody and you're the nobody, but in fact it's the opposite, because I know the story here. I know what you did. I know how you took care of Naomi and how you nurtured her and what it meant for you to leave everything behind and to come and to abandon it, to come to be with Naomi here and to become a Jew in this nation. I know how difficult that is, and you're a hero for doing that, and therefore you are the one who's heroic here even more than I am. And it's actually an act of Hakara. It's literally it's a Yehuda-style act of Hakara, again with that same key word, Lahakireni. So there's Hakara going on here. There's recognition going on in this story as well. Another theme from Yehuda and Tamar. Okay, I want to bring this to a close with bringing in one last theme, which is in this story. Ruth is famous for something. Who is Ruth? What is Ruth famous for? If I would say Ruth, and you would have to tell me two things about Ruth, what would you say? I say Ruth, you say?
Grandmother
of David. What else? Chesed. Ruth is over and over again ascribed to as a Baalat Chesed, right? In the beginning, Naomi says, you've done great chesed, you've done great kindness for your husbands, with the dead and with the living, and it's enough, go back already. But Ruth continues with the chesed, saying, no, I'm going to accompany you and I'll be with you. Boaz says, I know everything that you did for your mother-in-law and the chesed that you've done. Later on, by the way, even the yibum that she does is characterized, interestingly enough, as what? An act of chesed. When she finally confronts Boaz and says, I want you to marry me, you know what Boaz says? Hetavt chasdeich ha-shenim min ha-reishon. Your second chesed is even greater than your first chesed. What was the first chesed? That you took care of Naomi and you went back with her. What's your second chesed? That you're willing to marry me to perpetuate the legacy of your dead husband. L'vilti leich acharei ha-bachorim im dalim rash. Because the way of a young woman like you would be to go to find yourself a nice young husband, not to come after an elderly man like me. And you're sacrificing your own happiness, so to speak, for the legacy of your husband. That is a great chesed, he tells her. So if there's a character trait that seems to embody Ruth, it is that of chesed. That is what the story seems to assign her. But there's another thing which is not a character trait, but something that she goes through. Ruth becomes the archetype person in the Torah, at least in Nach, who is the convert. She's the archetypal convert. Laws of conversion are learned out from Ruth, right? So Ruth is a convert who is a Baalat Chesed. Have you ever heard this before? A convert who is a Baal Chesed. Chesed and conversion. Do those things go together? Is there anybody else that we meet ever in all of Chumash or Tanakh who combines the ideas of conversion and chesed? Abraham. Who's the first convert of all? Number one, Mr. Convert, the founder of Judaism itself, Mr. Convert, is Abraham. And who? What is Mr. Convert known for? Chesed. Isn't that fascinating? Mr. Convert in Chumash is known for chesed, and Mrs. Convert, Ruth, in Nach, is known for chesed. What is it about chesed and conversion that link these two together? And by the way, you see it in the verse as well. Did anyone pick up what Boaz says to Ruth? Listen to the words one more time. Tell me where you've heard these words. He says, I'm so impressed with your chesed. Hugayt hugadli et kol asher asit et chamotech. It was told to me everything you've done to her mother-in-law, achrei demoti sheikh, after your husband died. Listen carefully. V'ta'azvi avich v'imech v'eretz moladeteich. You left behind your mother and your father and your birthplace. Vatelchi el am asher lo yadat tamol shilsham. And you went to a nation that you didn't know from yesterday or the day before. What do those words remind you of? Lech lecha me'artzecha mi'moladetcha mi'beit avicha. Go forth now from your house, from your father's house, from your birthplace, and go to where? El ha'aretz asher ereka, to the land that you don't know anything about. Ruth leaves behind her father and her mother and everything and goes to a land and a people that she knows nothing about. Abraham leaves behind a land and a people that, and their father's house and goes to a land that he knows nothing about, a land that God will show him. So again, the clear parallel to Abraham, the two converts that both stand for chesed. What is it about conversion that links itself with chesed? Why is it that the convert should be someone who is also associated with chesed? Yes, you're going to say something?
No, I heard us share that, the concept of recognizing God. Like, well, why was Abraham the first person? There were so many people before him. It takes somebody who can think out of himself, who could stop being self.
Okay, good. That's exactly right. It takes someone who can think out of himself. Not just think out of himself, but act out of himself. What is so impressive about Abraham? Right? And I've said this before. What is so impressive about Avram? You know, we always think what's so impressive about Avram, he was the first, not just Jew, he was the first founder of monotheism, right? First guy with the philosophical brunt to be able to understand that the whole idolatry thing is a bunch of malarkey, and really there's one God, right? Okay, let me ask you a question. If that's what was so impressive about Abraham, that he was the first one to recognize monotheism, would you like to tell me how come that's never anywhere in the Torah? Did I ever bother you that Abraham as the founder of monotheism appears nowhere in the entire Torah? No, didn't bother you? When do we meet Abraham? When's the first time we really meet Abraham in the Torah? In Lech Lecha. God appears to this guy, Abraham, who's he? Beats us. He appeared a couple sentences before, right? And God says, Lech Lecha me'artzecha malarcha v'davicha, go forth from here. The hands of your father. Oh, who is this guy? Barach, I'm going to take care of you. Great nation, whole thing. Who is it? Now, the Medrash says, yeah, he was a monotheist. He destroyed the idols of his father. Destroyed them, showed everyone the big thing. Let me ask you something. I'm not arguing with the Medrash. Maybe the Medrash is true, right? But how come the Torah didn't tell us that? How come it takes the Medrash? I mean, you would think like that would be the central thing. You've got to tell us that about Avram. How could Iker Chasam Min HaSefer, how could you leave that behind? Not let us know that. This is the end of tape 6. The series continues at this point on tape 7.